Refugia, a podcast about renewal. Refugia are places of shelter where life endures in times of crisis. From out of these small sanctuaries, life re-emerges and the world is renewed. We're exploring what it means for people of faith to be people of refugia. How can we create safe places of flourishing, micro-countercultures where we gain strength and spiritual capacity to face the challenges ahead? I'm Deborah Reinstra, professor of English at Calvin University, and this is Refugia.
They were both academics, dad being a poet and teaching modern English and American poetry at University of Maryland, and Dirk teaching at Calvin, and a whole bunch of people that they knew around Calvin and among family and such who would want to have a community where people who could, you know, there could be musicians, there could be artists, there could be photographers and poets, and have this kind of place where people would interact around the lake. And it was a kind of utopian sort of vision that they had.
Hi, everyone. In this episode, we travel out to the shore of Lake Michigan and back in time. My guest, jazz musician David Jellema, grew up spending his summers at the family cottage near the lake, along with a whole group of other families. They were trying to establish an artist intelligentsia retreat, a little quasi-utopian community, at least during the summers. David's father, the poet Rod Jellema, was one of the founders of this community, and David reflects on how it came about and what it has meant to him. So this is an unusual episode about one little experiment in engineering a refugium. The place is called Lost Valley, and I love the poignance of that. It suggests both the loveliness and the ephemerality of that summer dream. The episode begins with David and me talking in the living room of the cottage David's father bought and repaired. Later, we'll move outdoors and down the beach road to the lodge, and then we end with a special treat, David reading one of his father's poems. Be sure to go to the Refugia podcast website to see the video version of this interview, complete with beautiful shots of the Michigan dunes. Meanwhile, thanks for listening. Today, I'm talking with David Jellema, who's going to tell us about the history of the colony. Hi, David.
Hello. Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Thanks for talking with us today.
Yep.
So tell us about this place. Tell us about the founding of the colony.
There's a time in about 1942, 1943 mm-hmm. that my father and Dirk Jellema, his first cousin, they were living in Holland. They decided that they were going to have an epic hike from Holland to Ludington and just walk the lakeshore.
How many miles is that?
Oh, I think it's like, I don't know, it's more than 120 miles.
Many, many miles.
Yeah. It's a long ways. It's a good deal of this lakeshore. And they one summer day they started out and spent about, I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks doing the walk.
Why did they want to do this? Youthful exuberance?
I think so. I think Dirk was about 15 and Dad was, you know, about 13 or 12.
Oh, they were just kids.
They were youngsters. And so they just decided that they wanted to explore the lake and do this kind of epic thing. Remind me to come back to the ending. It's got a very funny ending. But they had a little knapsack, you know, and they would bring some food and they would sleep out on the beach. And
Mom and Dad were okay with this?
Yeah.
It was a different time.
Yeah, certainly. And when they would get to channels, they would, you know, ask a fisherman or something to hoist them across the channel. At one point, they had to walk all the way around the lake that they had encountered. in order to get to the other side of the channel and keep walking.
Spring Lake, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it might have been at Whitehall where they had to, they had to, you know, barter with some guy who said, well, you know, what is it going to require? And they said, we have some great stories. So we'll tell you some stories. And he said, all right, you know, and he took him across.
This sounds like a Mark Twain novel.
Their dad's father came and picked them up in Ludington, after their epic journey, and, bought them not just one lunch, but two. Along the way, they had, were right about in this area, and they had come to a place that had a cottage or a barn. It looked like a red barn up on the hill. And I might be getting this mixed up with another structure that may have been there. Dirk's place was the red barn. Anyway, they found a place that had a stairway coming down to the beach, and they went up to knock on the door and say, you know, we need a glass of water, and there was nobody there. And peering inside, Dirk is already a historian. Dirk noticed that all the magazines and periodicals and stuff were set to one date in about 1937. And he said, this place hasn't been occupied since then. And Dad's like, oh, really? And they went and looked around and found a corral that was overgrown and such. So, years later, they figured out who Dirk came back to this area and was trying to figure out who owned this land and such, and found out actually who owned that place.
So it was empty when they went up there.
Yep. And remained empty.
Okay. And Dirk went on to become a historian.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And taught at Calvin and medieval history and Russian history.
Of the legendary Jellemas at Calvin.
Yes. And one of them. he eventually found the person who owned it. And by chance, this person was in town from Chicago, I think, and was here to pay the taxes on it. And Dirk tracked him down at his hotel and nice. Said, can I buy this from you? And I think that's when he got, the story that they had had this this couple that was living there had a child with a physical or mental disabilities, and the child one day tragically wandered outside of the gate and that had been left open by an assistant or a helper or something, and the little boy tumbled down the stairs and died.
Oh dear.
And so they just up and left and never came back. And
wow.
And so Dirk heard this story. I mean, he wanted to buy it. The guy thought about it for about 5 minutes and said, I'm ready to sell it, you know, 'cause they just came back to pay the taxes and never spent any time there anymore.
Mm. So it became a tragic place for them.
Yeah. And it turned out Dad and Dirk to be the sort of fledgling starting point for Dirk. Dirk was the man. Dad, I think, at the time was when Dirk was here looking into that possibility. Dad was in Edinburgh studying, Victorian literature.
So these two, let's go back to these two young teenagers walking along the beach, spotting this place, going and looking around.
Yeah,
and that stuck in their minds. There was something about that part, that point in the lake shore and that particular place that stuck in their minds so that later when they became young adults, they wanted to come back to it.
Yeah.
What is it about this spot, do you think, that intrigued them?
Well, that's a really good question. Part of it is that they had had their childhood on the lake shore. They had spent, you know, all their time there in Holland, grew up both in Holland.
So they grew up in Holland.
Well, Dirk may have been part of from Indiana, and I don't know how much time he spent there. But Dad grew up in Holland year round, and would have, they had places, cottages out at Maple Beach. My grandparents did, my grandfather's brother did. Anyway, we have ties to the beaches along there, and they would spend a lot of time, you know, sailing or making a sailboat or or fishing. They would go out on the lake and cast a line and catch a whole bunch of perch and bring it back and have a perch fry that day.
Yeah.
You know,
boyhood dream.
Yeah, and the lake had all sorts of magic to it. Uncle Harry Jellema, William Harry Jellema, would ask Dad, you know, do you think the lake is your friend? And Dad sort of never thought about this, but Harry said, you know, it's not, you better not think of this as your friend necessarily.
Why did he ask that question? What was he after?
Well, the boys spent so much time playing in the lake, and all of us have a story of something in which we had a moment of danger.
Oh, yes.
Either surfing or sailing or or just out there swimming, and when I was a little boy, there's a divot in the sandbar, and we found that divot, and suddenly we're under, and somebody had to come out and rescue us. And the undertows, of course, were epic.
Always respect the lake.
It's and we have books here on all the shipwrecks, the lake shipwrecks and things, and Dad was fascinated with that. But they always had this kind of profound sense that the lake was kind and benevolent, but at the same time was furious and indifferent.
It's a wild thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about the dunes? Your dad seems as if he was especially attracted to the beauty of the dunes.
Indeed. I don't know. I think they. It's just a kind of majesty of these. They would play on the dunes, and you have to traverse these things when you're getting up to the cottages, and so you burn your feet in the late afternoon sun on these, and you tumble down them or you know, sand surf down them or whatever. They're part of what gives us our our fortitude and endurance and flexibility as kids. But sleeping in the dunes is a kind of magical thing too. You're at the intersection there of sky and light and water and earth.
Yeah.
You're in the four elements are you know, right there at the shore with you. And I think that kind of magic is what has always drawn people here to this.
There's something primitive about it.
Yeah.
That connection to wind.
Yeah.
And light and water. So your dad and Dirk at some point said, let's buy land.
Yeah. Dirk especially, was the one who, well, those kind of details, I would have to refer you to, the recording of Dad telling these stories. The details of it. He bought 1 mile of property. He was shrewd and figured out that this wasn't going to be beachfront yardage.
Mm-hmm.
This was going to be farm acreage, and so he bought a whole bunch of it, a whole mile of it, really cheaply.
Because when was this? What year was this? Approximately.
'58, '59, '60, okay. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, he bought another mile north of here, but the cutoff mm-hmm. point was pretty much right down here at the end of Lost Valley Road. And the mile between here and what is called Gray Dunes were at the end of Eilers Road. Mm-hmm. That's where Dirk's house was. That's where that house was, and where he set up his cottage.
Did he build a new cottage?
Yes.
So yeah. He built something.
Yes, yeah.
But this place was actually in existence.
This was in existence. I think this was built in about 1890. So it's 125, you know.
Yeah, so it was built in that time when people from Chicago or St. Louis were coming to Michigan as their resort settlement and building.
Although this was a farmhouse and it was not used as a resort. It was not, and yes, there are some beautiful, beautiful resort places mm-hmm. along on White Lake or in Shelby. Mm-hmm.
So your dad saw this old farmhouse and it was a total wreck.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to fix it up.
He says, yeah, what do you want for it, Dirk? And I don't know what the payment was, you know, some ridiculous something. Dad probably spent $14,000 building it up, you know, and fixing it and mm-hmm. such. Maybe even less. This wing was added on much later. This was done during the early 80s, I think. Marty Schultz was the guy who did the actual work. Poor guy had so many headaches trying to figure out how to line things up and what to do with this crumbled fireplace and that, you know, some of the stuff was even coming down while he was working on it.
Nothing was plumb, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I understand that your dad and Dirk together had a kind of vision.
Yeah.
And the phrase that I've seen is an artist intelligentsia retreat. What is that? Did it happen?
Well, both of them were intelligentsias. They were both academics Dad being a poet and teaching modern English and American poetry at University of Maryland, and Dirk teaching at Calvin, and a whole bunch of people that they knew around Calvin and among family and such who would want to have a community where people who could, you know, there could be musicians, there could be artists, there could be photographers and poets, and have this kind of place where people would interact around the lake. And it was a kind of utopian sort of vision that they had.
Yeah. What drove them to seek that, do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, wanting to perpetuate something of their own childhood. Mm. The kind of people that they had in their lives, my grandfather and Dirk's grandfather, or father, I guess. Mm-hmm. And they were philosophers and teachers and lovers of life mm-hmm. and creative and such. And they saw that kind of vision in something that they could do with friends at Calvin and family members. And I think it was just a kind of desire to perpetuate that same mm-hmm. sort of magic that they had growing up on the lake, mm-hmm. And bring it to a place that was new, that was it had some things happening. There was that lodge down there when Dirk bought it, and it was. I don't dare venture into what kind of how that came about and such, but.
They didn't start that. That was actually there.
Yeah, that was there. Okay. And the Dunes Club structure was there too.
Okay. And there was a dream of a jazz club that never quite worked out.
I'm not sure what that was initially. I think it was a lodge and a restaurant. But when Dirk bought it, he made a restaurant out of it. There was one wing was fine dining, and the middle of it was a bar, and then another wing was a kind of a dance music hall.
So Dirk is a history professor.
Yeah.
At Kelvin, and now he's running a restaurant?
Yeah, people, I don't know, people in the 50s and 60s did a lot more with their lives. It's amazing what they got into, to me.
Maybe he had less grading than we do, I don't know.
Yeah, right. They're not as jaded, maybe.
Maybe he was just an extremely capable person.
Yes, he lost his shirt. You know, and in matters of selling, he wasn't nearly as keen as he was in buying. He had bought a property up in the Sleeping Bear Dunes, and some lawyers somehow sort of knived their ways into his legal weaknesses, let's say, and you know, so you see, he had a difficult time with losing money on his ventures.
But it was a beautiful dream.
He hired a jazz band to play every Saturday night from some local musicians. One guy from Baldwin, Michigan, who used to play at Jazz Limited in Chicago. It was a jazz club in Chicago. Guy named Don Engel. Don Engel was the son of someone named Red Engel, and Red Engel played with Spike Jones. Anyway, the connections go on, you know, on and on. There's another the cornet player of that band was someone who was becoming renowned for sounding like this classic historical early jazz cornet player named Bix Beiderbecke. And so they started a band with some people from Grand Haven, you know, high school and such. It was called the Jack Pine Savages. And the Jack
That's
Pine
a great name.
Yeah. The yeah. Jack Pine Savages, and there's a band now currently named Jack Pine Savages that have nothing to do with jazz at all.
Oh.
Interesting. But they played here for I'm going to guess, you know, 3 to 4 years fairly regularly. And I think even through the winter.
So that was another question I had. This was meant to be a summer retreat.
Yeah.
So the professors would all come out here in the summer with their families.
Yeah.
And have their intelligentsia artistic moments together. Going to the beach, going to the jazz club on Saturday night. Did it actually happen? How long did this Camelotian dream?
It fostered a much larger sort of development of people who wanted to come in and move away sort of from that vision. At least a good dozen years, there was this exciting kind of a sense that they were doing this.
We had something at this time.
Yeah,
you remember this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there was
some of the characters.
First one that comes to mind is George Ramsey, and George Ramsey had a cottage over here. He was an artist that taught in. Was it Wittenberg?
Okay.
University in Springfield?
Okay.
Maybe. And his wife, and they occupied that Dunes Club down there for a little while. They were the inhabitants there for a bit, and they kind of they were very important in the whole summer ventures at Lost Valley. that Dad and George and Dirk had envisioned, whereby they would have classes for kids, various classes. There was a local photographer here in a newspaper who came and taught some photography. There was a woman who had a place down here named Shannon. She had a lot, and she taught Spanish. The Spanish courses were it was hard to get little kids to try to speak Spanish. So we made paper mache things, and then we had sailing classes. And Dad did a poetry class, and Ramsey did a mural class where he taught the kids how to make a mural, and they did it on one of the walls of that Dunes Club, interior wall, in the front room there. So, and then, you know, Saturday, we would do those on weekends, and sometimes we'd get people from, you know, area elementary and junior high schools to come out and participate and such.
How old were you during this moment?
I think I was probably, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, something like that. Mm-hmm. It was at that restaurant. And I was 10 years old when I somehow me and a cousin Phil and maybe Michael was with me, my brother, and a couple other of the local kids, we were just sort of down exploring by the lake, and we sat on a dune right next to that, and it was fairly, we could see the lake from where we were. We're underneath the trees there, and there was this jazz band playing in there, and I had only been playing cornet for 1 year in elementary school, and I had been playing, you know, a little, Mary Had a Little Lamb and stuff, and I wasn't practicing, but I looked at this, and I thought, oh, that's what I could do, you know? And it was that band that sort of sparked me, and knowing that I was out there, you know, kind of interested, and they invited me in, maybe it was another Saturday or whatnot, but I got to meet the cornet player, and we talked about mouthpieces. I'm just kind of giddy and such. Bought the record and brought it home, and that's what I, you know, learned to play along with. Yeah. He eventually became a mentor of mine, and that very cornet that he was playing on, I'm playing on since about 1992. I bought it from him.
You still have it?
That's my gig horn, yeah. And it is from 1965, so it's as old as I am. Okay.
There's a lot of magic here in this place for you.
Oh, yeah. Another thing that happened when I was eight, my brother John and two friends, one really close friend from this area, mm-hmm. Almost like a cousin he was, Bill Smulligan, mm-hmm. And then a third boy who was a step cousin from South Carolina. They were coming home from our church in Claybanks Church up north of here, just a mile or so, a couple miles. And it was Sunday afternoon, and they were coming home, and there was a new stop sign, and they missed it and got killed. Mm-hmm. That afternoon, it was they died later that day. So, you know, we had some moments where the kids went over to a cousin's house, in Gray Dunes, and we at the where that corral was, and we rode horses for a little while, and then came back and found out that John had died. All three of them had. Yeah. Oh yeah.
You were just a kid.
Yeah. Eight. Mm-hmm. And it was, And it was right up at this corner here. You have to pass by this corner to get here.
Mm-hmm. How does that feel for you now?
The trees are not there anymore. The trees that they ended up next to are not there. And there was a period in my life when I would walk up to the corner every summer and just, you know, do a kind of, you know, a little pilgrimage walk and just go up to the corner and find four-leaf clovers all the way or see deer or, you know, have a, just have these kind of nice moments to myself. Yeah.
Your connection to this place isn't all joyful boyhood shenanigans. It's deep family connections.
Aunt Gret died here too, and I was with my girlfriend at the time. We went up and had, you know, tried to resuscitate her, and she had had a heart attack, and I had been just with her that morning, walking around around her parking lot, and just sort of, because she had been recovering from an operation, So tragedies, we've had a few among the Yalamas that and the relatives that have all stuck.
You live in Texas now. Why do you keep coming back here every year?
part of it was, until recently, of course, was just because I would be with my dad for some time. He was 90 when he died, and the past 10 years before that, we would come up here together and see what you're seeing right now, the birds and the sunshine and the breezes and the open windows wonderful, you know, food that we would get, just fish and corn and cherries the time together was really important. But also, I'm coming to the point where I'm starting to have a deeper sense that this is very much as much a part of mine as it was of Dad's. And when I've always kind of felt like this was Dad's place, even though I've had so much of my time here. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to imagine it being mine, because there have been a lot of people who have been through here, and a lot of people who have ties to this, mm-hmm. and a lot of people who have spent lots of love here. I'm feeling that coming back here, there are ties to that lake, especially. Mm-hmm. It's been a kind of spiritual womb for me. I mean, the death of my brother, my mom's death, first love, hearing a, you know, the jazz band, mm-hmm. for the first time, learning to surf from my brother, and all these kind of really, really formative, life experiences, mm-hmm. that have become so much a part of how I think in terms of my own spirituality, even,
yeah.
that life is a kind of transience. Mm. Life is not permanent. It's not anything you can necessarily count on.
Yeah. And there's something about that dune and that lake.
Yeah. Yeah.
And their ceaseless motion.
Yeah.
That resonates with that sense of transience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yet you always have a sense that you have a place where you can mm-hmm. enjoy that transience.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's almost the implacable indifference of it, in a way, that gives it that beauty and mm-hmm. that mystery.
When confronted with the idea, oh, you know, I've got to maintain it, I've got to pay for it, blah, 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 you know, all those things, they really become secondary to how important it is for me to have just a place that I call my own source in terms of places. I don't have the same kind of feeling in Bethesda, Maryland or Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I love those places. You know, Glen Echo, Maryland, where I spent quite a few years of my, you know, teenage and 20s and such. But I love Washington and would always go back and visit Dad, you know, once or twice a year if I could. And Washington does feel like a home. But the kind of draw of this is much deeper, much deeper. Mm-hmm. It's simpler, but it contains, you know, 90% of the ingredients that have made me what I am. Dad wouldn't insist that we get a job for the summer or mow lawns to make money or that kind of thing. And we were kind of spoiled that way.
Yeah.
But I think that's how he grew up, and he felt like that was a very, a generous, thing that his parents and his, ancestors did for him. And he imparted the same kind of latitudes for us.
It was part of the magic of the colony.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whatever happened to the colony? What's the state of things now? What's the future of it?
I don't think there is much of a colony per se. You know, we get a lot of people who are friends of original owners and who don't have the same kind of experience of the vision.
At this point, David and I made the short trip from the cottage to the beach, where we stand near the lodge, where long ago families gathered for restaurant meals and live jazz. And we reflect a little bit on what has happened to the colony since the old days.
Imagine the different kinds of inspirations that people got from various moments here. That was something that had altered my life. You know, and Dad's teaching poetry in one of these little places, or, you know, everybody has something from here that was, like, you know, formative and very precious.
About this idea of Refugia as a place where life continues when the outside world is in crisis or...
Yeah.
And we create those places, and they aren't really meant to last forever, but they're meant to be little incubators of new life. And it seems like that's what this place was meant to be, and was for you.
But it's also kind of continuity for my life. It's sort of a grounding in my own life, you know, because a lot of my life has gone this way and that way and this way and that way, and this has always been here. I like that idea of a refugia. Mm-hmm.
To conclude the episode, we asked David to read one of his father's poems for us. He chose Travel Advisory. You'll find a link and more information at our website.
This is a few poems by Rod Jellema from a book he wrote called A Slender Grace, some collected poems. Travel Advisory. Remind yourself when you wake to a strangeness of foreign lights through blowing trees out the window of yet another hotel, that home is only where you pretend you're from. What's familiar sends you packing, watching for some lost place called home. You're from wherever you go. Don't admit what you're looking for if you say to a baker in Bremen, to a barmaid in Provence, back home we think of you here as having deeper lives. They'll shrug you wrong and won't respond. And then you'll know they're strangers too. Broken and wrinkled stones and skin, brush strokes and cords, old streets and saints you've read about, flute notes in the laughter of foreign children, the nip of a local market cheese. There's a life we almost knew once. Watch. Just let it in. The return ticket will take you only to the town where you packed to get on the plane. It never missed you. You'll notice alien goods in your kitchen, wind in a wall, losses in the middle drawer of your desk. Even there, the strange is the cup of communion you drink, that dim, outlandish Civitas Dei. You're a citizen of never was a place. Remember not to feel too much at home.
This has been Refugia, a podcast about renewal. Find us on the web at refugiapodcast.com and leave us a comment. Send us your ideas about what Refugia means for you. You can also find me, Deborah Reenstra, on Facebook and Twitter at Deborah K. Reenstra.